You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Scott Durley and Carissa Carter, co-authors of Assembling Tomorrow, a guide to designing a thriving future. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
It's the introduction, and it's called On the Verge. It opens up the quote, which is this: "It may be that what we have is a world not on the verge of flying apart, but an uncreated one, still in shapeless fragments, waiting to be put together properly." And that's from Catherine Ann Porter, an article called "The Future Is Now" from Mademoiselle magazine in 1950. 70 years from tomorrow will be a special day. Someone will feel the immense pressure of progress and be paralyzed by possibility. Someone will rekindle a species. Someone will regret the impact of what they've put into the world. Someone will confuse code for consciousness. On this day, your youngest grandchild will unbox their first tabletop nuclear fusion generator. The instruction book will be more than 3 centimeters thick, not because it's complicated to run a nuclear fusion generator at home, but because there are at least 50 warnings in as many different languages. Do not disassemble. Do not link with additional generators. Not for use by children under 6. Use of nuclear fusion to harm others will result in prosecution. The generator itself will weigh no more than a carton of milk. Something so powerful should weigh more, they will think. But the instruction book, rather, the warning book, will have a respectable heft. A lot could go wrong. Even more could go right. A lot could go wrong even when everything goes right. To be a maker in that moment, 70 years from tomorrow, will be to shape the world, to craft new possibilities, and repair mistakes using the pieces that have come before. 70 years ago yesterday was its own special day. On that day, someone broke ground on a radiant city of tall, evenly spaced high-rise buildings, hoping to solve the social problems of the era. Someone imagined a network of data spanning the globe, all accessible right from your desk. Someone questioned their role in building a bomb. Someone implanted an electric pacemaker on a human heart for the first time. On that day, someone sketched out the designs for a giant plane that would bring people together around the globe. That plane would bring world peace as cultures mixed and mingled, or so they hoped. Also, larger planes would mean the airline could sell more seats. The plans for the plane were drawn by hand with pencil lead, set squares, and steel rules. And the finished plane would emit more carbon dioxide than almost any other plane on the planet. To be a maker in that moment, 70 years ago yesterday, was to rebuild the world itself, to make big changes in a world that had previously been making us instead. By then, humankind had already made the move from what design philosophers Ann Pendleton Julian and John Seely Brown call working in the world to working on the world. The things people made were no longer sitting tidily within the bounds of nature and society, but were actively altering both on a grand scale. Today, too, is a special day. Today, someone is putting the finishing touches on a machine learning algorithm that will change the way you relate to your family. Someone is trying to design a way to communicate with animals in their own language. Someone is designing a gene that alters bacteria to turn your poop bright blue when it's time to see the doctor. Someone is cleaning up the mess someone else left behind 70 years ago yesterday. Today, someone has just had an idea that will end up saving one thing while it harms another. All days are special in their own ways, but we happen to live in a time of quickening history when what has been brewing for years coalesces overnight. We live in a time that defines the line between before and after. Today is an era of runaway design, in which the things people make, whether they be everyday products, hybrid workspaces, viral media posts, recycling systems, gene therapies, artificial intelligence bots, nuclear fusion generators, or anything in between, tangle with our environment and emotions in unpredictable ways. Our byproducts modify the biosphere, and our data sets drive decisions, making the impacts of our actions hard to anticipate, notice, and repair. We live in a moment when the materials of making are blurring the lines between people, technology, and the natural world. Technology is getting more human-like as computers take on the task of thinking for us and themselves. Nature is merging with technology as line-editing DNA bases becomes an everyday occurrence. Meanwhile, our minds and media are so intertwined and entangled that it's making our nervous systems nervous. These things, the quickening, the tangled upness, and the shifting roles of materials and machines, are the ingredients that make today special, fraught, and full of potential. To be a maker in this moment, to be human today, is to collaborate with the world. It is to create and be created, to work and be worked on, to make and be made. To be human is to tinker, create, fix, care, and bring new things into the world. It is to design you, yes, you. Might design products or policies, services or sermons, production lines or preschool programs. You might run a business, make art, or participate in passing out meals to the poor. You might write code or pour concrete, lobby for endangered species legislation, or craft cocktails. Wherever you fit in, you are part of shaping the world. This is design work.
This moment feels really overwhelming. Like, we're overwhelmed with the technology, our climate's on the fritz, and it can feel really unsettling. Yet at the same time, as people that craft learning experiences, we know how much agency each of us has as individuals. And so we wanted to write the book to call attention to the complexity and the feeling of overwhelm of this moment, and then also to share things that anybody can do to launch ourselves into that better future.
So if you look at the internet and the creation of the internet, the idea was to move information quickly. And that's great, and that has been great, but there have been a lot of things where they didn't take into account the fact that, well, there are people attached to all that information, and those people are experiencing emotions, and the things that we're designing are actually exciting and aggravating our emotions. And so you take something like social media, which is really about the speedy spread of information, and what you see is it also brought along with it, you know, teen depression and body image issues and political polarization.
One thing to know is that every single climate visualization that we see out in the world, whether that is a map of rising temperatures around the country, around the globe, or rising sea level or wildfire, like all of that has design decisions behind it. I am also with you that we need to get more people understanding the impacts of their own actions on climate change and being aware of what's happening to the planet. So one is to be able to interpret that work and really interrogate it for what it is. So to be able to read any infographic and what we call deconstruct it, understand like what emotions is it evoking in you, gut reaction, why those are happening, and like literally what has the designer done to make you feel that way. So that literacy in reading infographics is one piece. And then to give you very specific examples, in one of the classes that I teach and co-teach with a geoscientist, Kate Maher, and an infographic designer, Catherine Madden, we have students visualize what is known as the climate swerve. So this idea that humans have agency over shifting climate, it was coined the climate swerve by Jay Lufton a number of years ago. And that concept is one that the more that we have people both sourcing what is the information and how to present it, that we feel gets that climate literacy in our brains and gets that message across. And you can see it in really interesting ways. So we have students visualize climate anxiety and where is that cropping up overlaid with like, where should people feel anxious about climate? We even had a student group that visualized the themes of major Marvel movies throughout the past 20 plus years. A lot of the themes have started to be much more climate related, kind of showing how these topics are ingrained in popular culture too.
We have an assumption that technological innovation outpaces government regulation. That's a very well-founded assumption because that's how it goes. However, I think we need to start thinking differently, and we should be able to imagine that we can create legislation that precedes the impacts of the things we're creating. So if we see a potential effect coming,
we should be able to put in a sort of preemptive law, I think, to be able to address it prior to the effect actually happening, which we do in a lot of ways. There's tons of examples of that. But I think basically the pace of legislation needs to accelerate so that it can really grapple with the pace of technological innovation. But then if you do that, you have to be ready for the fact that that legislation might be off, right? It's speculative. It's anticipatory. You're not necessarily going to get it right. So I think we also need to build in mechanisms into the laws that make them responsive and changeable. So let's have a speculative legislation. We'll put a law out there, a regulation that's speculative, but let's have built-in checks that are constantly checking, like, is this working the way we wanted it to? And it needs to be easy to change if it's not, which is also not built into the system. So I think, like, we need to be able to imagine things working in ways in which we aren't used to them working. And one, I think, is legislation being quick and responsive when generally it's sort of slow and hard to change. That's a one thing that I could really think could help.
Scott and I like to kick around imaginative ideas for types of legislation, right? One idea is like a look both ways technology, where let's say we have a big new social media-like technology that's about to be launched, and AI and all sorts of algorithms, like that would fit within that bucket. Is there a moment where there's a trial period with technologies like that, where we have some ideas as to how they might need to be governed, that we could put those in place and then use that, say, 2-year period of time when that technology is learning how it's going to actually work once it's in place? And we both look historically, looking back, look that way, and see, like, how have other technologies similar to this affected our world? What should we be looking for in terms of the effects that it might be having both on our individual persons as well as our societies? And then to also look the other way, like look forward, do some visioning as to what might come to pass 10, 20, 30 years down the road. The intangibles are really about what are those forces that are coming together that are making this moment feel quite unsettling. And those being the fact that everything is interconnected and flows between each other, and the feelings that you were talking about before, as well as our human propensity to make stories and make believe and come up with narratives to connect ideas, whether they exist or not, the very human characteristics. And our actionables are like, what are ways to like notice those forces that are happening, to see the unseen, so that each one of us can be more aware of what's happening and build the world for the better?
The way our brains work is not really indicative of how the world works. There's a reason for that. Us being able to pay attention to certain things and ignore others allows us to navigate. But it shouldn't be mistaken for an understanding of our holistic view of the world. There's a concept that we talk about in the book called the Umwelt. And the idea of an Umwelt is it's what your senses can take in. And all different species have different. So as an example, cockroaches sense movement in a way that we don't. Butterflies can see infrared light and we can't. Butterflies can actually taste with their feet, which is kind of an amazing thing. And I'm kind of glad that we don't, frankly. But the point is that just even through our senses, and you can talk about that in terms of everything, right? My understanding of a situation is going to be different than your understanding of a situation. The way I think of a story of what happened is going to be different than the way you thought of a story. And there's a man named Gregory Bateson, who is an environmentalist. And he talks about how most of the problems in the world are actually a problem between the way people think and how the world works. And they're not the same thing. So the way we understand the world and how that world actually works is just not mapped perfectly. And that kind of leads to problems because we don't know exactly what we're doing in the world. We can't see all the repercussions of the things we create until later on. One silver lining, though, about the technologies that we're creating is that technologies like AI could be used to help us with this issue, with the fact that our mental models aren't exactly in line with how the world works. So AI is actually very good at predicting, at modeling outcomes. It could be used to understand climate change better so that we're able to understand that in a way that allows us to act. It could also help us predict the impacts of the things that we're making. So there's a bit of a silver lining in here, even though it can feel scary to be in a situation where your mental model and how the world works are not in line.
As you reflect on AI, how do you feel it's going to change the future of education, the future of work, the way it's changing, the way we communicate with ourselves and our imaginations and talk about perception, even the way we perceive ourselves, our sense of self, as all these things change, that's changing as well.
Well, one is it's absolutely going to change us. I think the sooner that we can be very proactive, I'll say too, I don't know if I want to be changed. And I think a lot of people are feeling that too, but it is going to change us. And so it's not going to help to pretend like it's not happening, but I do think we can all be very proactive in noticing the changes it's having on us, on our children, on our planet, and from every scale, from that like large system-wide, you know, energy footprint scale, all the way down to, I won't even call it minuscule, but like, I worry that AI is changing my thoughts and can control my thoughts. And that, you know, used to sound really far-fetched and now sort of like maybe middle of the road, but I guarantee like in a year's time that will sound like a very normal concern, because the reality is we are being, if you think about the phenomena of social listening, is very, very sophisticated. And this is the idea that all of the data in the websites that we visit, the data trails that we leave out in the world are tracking us, our locations and our behaviors and our habits, such that there are many sites out there that can predict exactly what we're thinking and feeling and feed us advertising content or things that aren't even advertising content that can change what our next behaviors are. And I think that's getting more and more sophisticated. And I think world where we have already seen our political elections be affected by mass attacks on our social media, et cetera. Like when that comes down to our individual agency and behavior, I think that that's something that we do need to be concerned about. The way that we as individuals can combat it is to be aware that it's happening, right? Like is to really start to notice the unnoticed. And I still feel really optimistic amongst this concern. When we are prototyping new design ideas with students, we love this mantra that the prototype should never be more resolved than the idea. So like if you want to make a new chair and you're really just like concerned with how much space it should take up, you make that thing out of cardboard so that you just get an idea of space. You don't make it at its final beautiful wood and leather resolution, because then you're going to be looking at like, does this texture feel right? You're not going to be thinking about the amount of space it's taking up. But with AI, like you're right, that manicness, that hallucinations, when they appear exactly the same as something that we are used to as just this like representation of search, et cetera, that's very confusing. That is confusing to our brains. And if you're working quickly, you can miss it.
You mentioned digital smog, Mia, and something Carissa and I have been talking about lately is as you move from the industrial era to a media era, the landscape of what we're working with changes. So in a media landscape, the environment is not just the trees and the water and the air. It's actually our minds. You know, it's our emotions and it's our feelings and it's our mental models and it's our imagination. And so our brains are kind of the environment in which all these new media updates and designs are playing out. Where does pollution show up? Pollution shows up in political polarization. It shows up in difficulties with mental health. And I think we need to think of our imagination in a media space as a public resource that needs to be protected. It's like our collective imagination, the sum total of our individual imaginations and how they affect each other is really important to start thinking about with a conservation mindset.
This is like this kind of silent spring moment of the media era. When you're thinking about a creative field or just even bringing creativity to whatever field you have, creativity is often about like finding the hidden thing, finding the thing that nobody else is seeing and taking it to reality. Not to think that make-believe or imagination or weird ideas are not worth it. Like I had some mentors in my life that just allowed me to understand how you should take make-believe seriously. Because if you go down this kind of wild path, you find something that's beyond what's going on. And eventually, the world is going to make it normal and it's going to integrate it. Otherwise, it just like won't, it won't work. So don't worry about being out there. Like it's, we need people to be thinking beyond what is toward what could be. I think that's number one. And the second thing is that the way you do things is as important as the things you do. So it's not just about the product. It's about how you do it, because how you do it actually has more repercussions sometimes than the product. You know, you might create a great product, but everyone who's working on it is angry and the people you're trying to serve aren't excited about it, or they've been taken advantage of to be able to make it come into the world. And that leaves more bad stuff that's a little harder to see, but has an equal or bigger impact. So just how you make it is as important as what you make.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.